On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour
with Virginia Trioli.
Good morning. Great to have your company on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria. Yes, The Conversation Hour with me, with some librarians, and with my old boss who's here as well. She used to be the head of news and current affairs. And for a moment there, we all thought she might have ended up being the managing director of the ABC too. We might get to that as well. She's rolling her eyes at me and giving me looks. Her name is Kate Tawney. She's the CEO of the State Library of Victoria and has just had the wonderful job, task, of opening and unveiling a refurbished Queen's Hall Library in the jewel in the cultural crown in Victoria and Melbourne, which is the State Library of Victoria. Kate, good morning.
Good morning. I don't think anyone's ever bossed you around, just to be clear.
That's not true. You were very bossy.
Yes, I've had a lovely week last week.
You had a nice week, haven't
just
you?
Celebrating this fantastic redevelopment of what is such a beautiful institution and a much loved institution. Mm. Victorians love their libraries.
And used.
Yes, absolutely.
I whenever I go through the library, which is, you know, not often, but from time to time, I often do think, how much electricity do you have to pay for all the students go in there? They all find the spare PowerPoints,
yes,
and they all plug their mobile phones in and sit against walls and against,
yes,
you know, that's right.
In fact, that's
the skirting boards and read a book
floor
and charge their phone.
And they do much more than that. But actually, that was exactly why we undertook this redevelopment, because we had that lovely problem of having run out of space. So,
yeah,
as a cultural institution and a library, if you think about 20 years ago when people were really predicting the demise of libraries, how amazing for a state library to be so popular that you couldn't find a seat.
It's true. That's part of the reason why I don't go there. I would happily go and do, you know, the research or writing that I do from time to time in the beautiful domed reading room, but I can't find a spot.
But now you can. So there are 70% more seats now. And that was exactly what the whole vision was, to say, well, look at this incredible building, and it's 23 different buildings. So over the years, over 163 years,
yeah,
there have been 23 separate buildings. It's now an entire block. So it was an opportunity to say, okay, let's look at the footprint. And we know that we've got people who want traditional library spaces and services.
Mm.
They want quiet spaces. They want areas where they can look at the collection and see the collection. But we've also got students who want to come in and collaborate and talk. So it was a chance to say, let's look at the whole thing. How do we zone it and how do we redesign it so that there's spaces for everyone, so that kids and their parents and carers can come in without necessarily annoying people who want that quiet space in the dome. So there's 70% more seating. So come in, there's spare seats.
And a spare plug that I can plug.
And a spare plug. That's the whole point too. More PowerPoints.
The State Library will donate you electricity, and I think that's a lovely public service. I spent a long period of time, a couple of years, 3 years really, coming in and out of Queen's Hall, which has been shuttered for 16 years, I think, because that was the art library, and that's where you kept the art books and the art periodicals, some very old magazines that I was reading, and some old art journals that are bound in the big, you know, huge leather bindings.
Yes.
And it was the most lovely room in which to do my
it's
work.
It's a stunning room. And if you think about it, for that not to have been open to the public for 16 years, it's just lovely to hand that back, because it is, for those of you who haven't been there, it is just this beautiful space. And it was the original library reading room for the library. And so it was flooded with light. It was beautifully designed. And so now it's very much in keeping with the legacy of that original design, but with a 21st century twist.
I'm going to be in a minority of one in saying this, but nonetheless, I know you've taken, scraped the paint off the skylights, and you did the same with the beautiful renovation of the domed reading room, and all of a sudden it became a bright room.
Yes.
It was always a dark room. I like working in dark spaces. I know.
No, you weren't. You're not alone.
Oh,
in
really?
That.
Okay.
And actually, Jeff Kennett told me when I first got the job, because he was very much behind the funding for the La Trobe Reading Room and yes. the massive refurbishment of that many years ago. And he said that he was really proud of it, but he said he remembers the talkback callers to the ABC and the letter writers
would
to
have
the
been
Age
John's program, yes.
saying. That you know, they missed that
too
dark
bright.
Indigenous. It's not. It's beautiful. It's inspirational.
And that's concentrate.
And that's what the original design was.
Was it?
It was covered over. All of those skylights were covered over because the library didn't have the money to, in fact, ensure that the rain and there wasn't water damage.
Yeah.
So that was the original design, and it's all in keeping with the original design.
Which one did Jeff Kennett prefer, dark or light? Did he say
the light? He loved the light. Mm-hmm. He brought the light into that space. So the Kennett government provided the funding, and I think it was finished under the Bracks government. So, you know, it is a tribute to generations of the Victorian public, but also the state governments over the years for investing in this library.
Mm.
And again, you know, in 2019, for that library to be busier than it's ever been before, I think it's fantastic.
I remember a story you told me in the very early days when you started at the State Library, and I remember saying to you, there's a podcast in this and one day we'll have to get onto that. But you were walking through the building and getting to know every single part of it and every bit of it when you started in the job after leaving the ABC. And there was – and stop me when I get the story
yes.
right, but then you can pick it up. And there was a curator who was with fine pieces of thread, stitching and mending. Was it Captain James
yes.
Cook's jacket?
Yes, his waistcoat.
His waistcoat.
Absolutely amazing. In fact,
what was she doing?
We're going to hear from my amazing colleague who leads the conservation department, and that is just one of thousands of treasures that they work on. But the beautiful thing about this was that they were preparing that, I think, for exhibition. I'm not quite sure. But the lovely thing, as she described, you can see with that waist jacket, it was let out as he got a little bit fatter and fatter. So the thing about the items in the collection is all of them have stories within stories within stories. And often it's the people in the conservation lab or a colleague that we're about to speak to in rare books, you know, they have the stories behind the stories. And that for us is... That's our next challenge, to actually say we've got beautiful spaces, come and share those spaces. But at the heart of what we do is the collection.
You have these amazing collections.
And our programming around
that. Yeah, and we don't see enough of them.
Yeah.
You need more buildings.
No, we need to share our collection. We need to think about that.
What's the most shocking or surprising book or holding that you've discovered there at the State Library?
It's like sort of saying, you know, which is your favourite child?
Yeah, but everyone has one.
one of them is an incredible thing that the thing that has shocked me and sort of confused me most, which my colleague Anna can speak about in a minute. But it's a walnut, and it's a walnut, and inside. It was it's kind of royal paraphernalia. Inside is a number, tiny, a little Constantina photographs of the royal family. And actually Anna might be able to talk about the background to it. But it was collected, and somehow it ended up in the library collection.
Which royal family?
Quirky, I think it was the turn of the century.
Right, okay, so Victoria.
Yeah, just amazing little relics that, you know, all of a sudden, there it is.
Is there any part of you that misses journalism?
No. I just feel so lucky. You know, I loved every day of my career as a journalist, and I loved every minute of my time at the ABC. And I sort of feel so lucky to have left a job that I felt was a vocation and to have found another job that I feel equally as passionately about. And I'm very conscious that not everyone finds a passion. I feel as though I found two, and I feel so lucky that that's happened.
quick ABC quiz then while I've got you here. Barry Cassidy's replacement, David Spears. What do you think?
Oh, fantastic. Absolutely brilliant. Now, what a coup for the ABC. And David would not mind me saying that we tried to get him a number of times over in a number of different roles. So I think that will be just terrific. And I think it's really interesting in a program like ABC News Breakfast, which has managed to increase its audience at a time when that is so difficult.
Nobody does.
I think that's a great coup for the ABC, because if anyone is going to be able to carry on Barry's legacy, it's David.
Mostly Victorian shows that are increasing their audience. What else did I ask you? Managing Director of the ABC, currently doing an okay, good,
oh,
or
fantastic.
Great job.
Fantastic. Absolutely. It's a really
company line here this morning is all I'm
getting.
I'm
not the company, though. Disclosure that David is absolutely a friend, and it is a really tough job. That gig is a really tough job.
Well, how are we going to handle this massive budget cut, do you think? I mean, what would be your suggestion?
I don't know. I run the State Library of Victoria very happily, Virginia Trillo. You're a shocker. But look, again, institutions like the ABC, institutions like the State Library, they have long legacies, and you know, you're a custodian of that kind of institution for a short period of time.
Yeah.
And you carry that legacy. It's, you know, it's important.
It's tricky, though, for all of us.
Yeah.
This is a cultural institution, as well as being a news organisation and a storyteller and all the other things, and an emergency broadcast that the ABC is, and you're an institution as well. But at this time when it's just impossible to establish what the truth or facts might be, and in a time of fake news and such distrust and scepticism about what we do, what's the best way of at least attempting to restore that trust?
Well, I think, and this is something that we are absolutely thinking through and focused on at the State Library, because I think that public discourse is so alienating and alienated at the moment. You're in your camp and you stay in your camp, and more the information that you source is reinforcing your own opinion. So, you know, an institution like the Library, like the ABC, really at the heart of that is access to free information, but also encouraging robust, civil discourse. And I think there's a role. I think it's interesting that the library is full. You will never get a more diverse group of people in one place.
That's what it looks like when I go through it.
So for us, the next step is to say, that's sensational. It's fantastic to have people there. But how do we start conversations across those divides? How do we start to really encourage debate, discourse outside your bubble? Because I think more and more we're all in our bubbles.
Do you think it's possible, isn't it, though, that even the people who are there, that diverse group of people inside the State Library, that they're all seeking out information online or in books or periodicals that just shore up their pre-existing views as well?
Possibly, but they're curious. They're in that building because they're curious. They're seeking information. They're seeking ideas. They might be seeking just a retreat from the world. I think there's something that we can offer in terms of our programming, in terms of telling the stories that we've got in our collection, to really encourage people to talk across divides that I think are just cementing at this point in time.
I think you need a computer program at the State Library. So, you know, 10 minutes into your session, a pop-up comes up. Have you considered, you know, reading or looking at? Here's a link to. Here's a different idea you might not have considered.
I tell you what, this is a lovely example of, I think, a role that we can play. The library also understands that, you know, we have a responsibility to partner. So one partnership we've got at the moment, which is a really valuable partnership, is La Trobe University. Yeah. Next year, on a daily basis, we are going to get La Trobe's greatest minds, whether they're students, lecturers, researchers, etc. And every day we will have pop-up conversations, short and sharp, and we'll be letting people in the library know that they're happening. So just 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's actually trying to take complex ideas and presenting those to a group of people who might not vaguely be in that space. That's the kind of thing that a library can do. And that's not just the State Library. That's public libraries across Victoria, you know, really vibrant community hubs.
It's like the old Speaker's Corner, but sort of bringing it inside.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You should call it Change My Mind.
Oh, is he done? Thank you.
No, you can't have that title. I was planning on that for something I want to do next year too. Maybe we can do it together. Kate Tawney is with you. She's the Chief Executive Officer of the State Library Victoria. Anna Welch, who's a book historian, curator and senior librarian in the History of Book Team at the State Library of Victoria. And the 2020 Harold Wright Scholar in the Prints and Drawings Collection at the British Museum. Oh, my goodness. And there's a collection that we could spend an hour talking about. And also Shelley Jamieson, the head of collection care at the State Library of Victoria, with me and with Kate Tawney this morning. Anna and Shelley, good morning. Welcome to the Conversation Hour.
Hello.
I don't know quite where to begin. I feel like a bit of a kid in a lolly shop. I want that one, I want that one, I want that one, and I want them all. But I think we'll start with the State Library's Christmas party. How did you roll, Kate? What happened?
We are just wild.
Yeah, the State Libraries would be crazy. Yes.
So the theme, you had to come as an item in the collection, so which was just fantastic. And I tell you what, the team to beat is always conservation, because they are so incredibly creative and have all of the materials at their fingertips.
Oh,
yeah.
You can make
costumes and stuff. Well, that's not fair.
Shelley came as the genealogy collection.
You came as the genealogy.
Yes, what it was very conceptual.
What does it look like?
Well, it was all in my head, and it involved planes and boats and pictures of my family, and I had some LED lights in there and a lighthouse.
Oh, so you told the story of your family through what was on your head.
Genealogy, yeah.
Brilliant. Okay. What did you cover, Anna?
I'm ashamed to say I wasn't actually there. I was at a conference with the Bibliographical Society, because in the Rare Books team we never rest.
I was going to say, that is your idea of a party, isn't it?
Well, yeah. You know, we went wild in our own way.
What did you come as, Kate?
I drew from the collection of floral paintings and pictures.
Yeah.
So, yeah, mine was really...
You just came in a floral dress, didn't you?
No, I just had beautiful images from the collection over me.
You're not pleased with your costume, then?
No. Yeah. Well, it's just the bar is so high. The best, though, and I think the winner, was someone who came as one of the library's columns. She literally
the ionic
made
column.
A column.
Yes. Yeah.
And the theme was integrity.
Oh,
I know.
How nice.
It's fantastic.
That. That's very, very clever.
A fantastic gum nut baby.
Mm-hmm. I want to start with that Captain Cook vest.
Waistcoat.
So that you've painstakingly restored. What threads did you have to use to match to an Enlightenment waistcoat?
It's actually quite a simple waistcoat. So it's cotton. Mm. Oh, it's wool on the front and cotton on the back, and quite raw on the back. And so we just had to match the woolen threads, because it had, you know, a little insect had a munch on it a few years ago. So we had to fix up some of the holes, and stabilise that and make a support so we can, you know, display it on the support.
What are the most important tools that a head of collection care will have in her third drawer in her desk? just name them for us. Just what might they be?
I think there'd be probably a scalpel and some tweezers and maybe a little probe or a scraping instrument.
Packet of mothballs?
No, mothballs are now banned.
Oh, but, are they?
Yeah, we don't use mothballs.
What do you use
anymore.
Instead?
We use a process called the integrated pest management process.
You call someone to come in who sorts things for you.
Yeah, and you just make sure that you keep all the insects at a reasonable level, so they're not going to be eating your collection. So we try and we monitor them. We're very interested in that.
So you learn to live with a degree of insecticide.
No insecticide. The whole
You learn to live with a degree of insects in the building, right?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. How interesting is that?
At a very low level.
Okay. And I actually want to start with that position of yours, being the Harold Wright Scholar in the Prints and Drawings Collection in the British Museum, because I know that the British Museum has... The word extraordinary won't cover the Prints and Drawings Collection there.
That's right. It's an extraordinary place to be able to spend some time as a curator to learn from that collection.
How far back does the collection go?
Well, the Prints and Drawings Collection, I mean, the printed material starts in the middle of the 15th century and comes all the way forward to works created this year. So it's huge. Yes, encyclopedic, I think, is the right word.
Incredible. Mm. Does the staff there really know what they have?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, okay. Some of the best experts in the world work at the British Museum and all their departments, so it'll be a privilege to learn from them while I'm there.
Oh, just
I think Anna is underselling herself because she is a world expert as well. And that's the lovely thing about the library. Yeah. There's so many incredibly talented people across the board in different departments.
So tell us about some of the more the least known but quite incredible books that we have in our collection. Can you share a couple of them with us?
Well, the library has a really remarkable collection, both in Australian terms but also globally. And one thing that came to my mind just because of our talk about insects and pests just now was a book that's very close to my heart because I did some research into it. It's a medieval manuscript that is actually owned by the Franciscan friars in Australia, and they have it on a sort of long-term deposit arrangement at the library so that it can be well cared for. And it's a book that was made in Italy at the end of the 13th century. And in 2008, it was very lovingly conserved by my colleagues, Shelley's team, to prepare it for an exhibition. And as part of that, they cleaned this manuscript. And one of the many different things that came out of the book was a tiny little flea, which turns out to be an oriental rat flea that is the sort that carried the plague.
Oh, wow.
And as that book was in Italy in the period of the plague, we have that very carefully sealed in a small jar, and we only get it out to scare school children.
I was going to say, did some immunologist somewhere in the world want to get their hands on that flea to look at it for particular research purposes?
Well, we would love to have more research into that material, actually, but it's a really nice example of a collaboration between the library and the museum staff.
Which, yes, because you wouldn't need the museum to identify what it was.
That's right. The entomologist from the museum had a look at it and were able to identify it. And we hope that there will be more chance for research like that, especially between our two great collections.
That's incredible. It's possible, isn't it, that there are dozens and dozens more finds like that somewhere up in the stacks of the library that you don't yet know about?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the most exciting things about a library, is that it's a never-ending repository for research and new ideas. A book might be sitting there, and we might know it's there, it's been catalogued, it's on the shelf, you can find it. But until the right person with the right question comes along, it's just dormant, it's waiting to be
enlightened. Or you might not know that between pages 72 and 73 is the love letter.
Absolutely.
Slipped in between the pages that proves the theory that we've had for years and years, and suddenly we now know.
That's right.
This manuscript's got a beautiful little prayer at the end. So it's finely written and illustrated. But someone has scribbled a little prayer for the chickens.
That's
on the very last page, and it's just like a scribble, you and I.
A prayer for the chickens.
For the chickens.
It's in Italian, I guess, is it?
No, it's in Latin.
Is it in Latin?
So it's a prayer probably written by one of the original Franciscan friars in the 13th or 14th centuries who was using that book to pray for the chickens and the orchards and all the things that go into making a good life.
How amazing. The job that you do, Shelley, is the head of collection care. Does that mean that everything comes to you, that you conserve from book to print and painting to costume?
No, not every. It's probably gone through a lot of decisions before it comes to us, before it's a priority, because it's never ending. You know, the library's always being used and the collections are always being used. So it's about priorities with the exhibitions and what's on display.
But I guess I'm asking about your skill set. Does it, the skill set of the team, does it cover all of that?
So we're very strong in paper and books and photography, and then we get external conservators and collection specialists and objects and textiles. And I'm just thinking, we've even just got a gun in recently, so we'll probably have a look at a gun.
Where's the gun from?
The gun's from the Cass collection, so it's one of our manuscript collections, and he was a World War One. He was in World War One. And it's his collection and his wife's collection.
Right.
And so part of that, you know, it's got documents and photographs, and then one of the items is a gun. So we're just sort of thinking about that.
It's a great example of an incredible collection and the layers of stories within that collection, because it's the story, it's historian, it's a World War One story, But it's a story of, it's a love story as well. It's their love story, that we've got letters that they wrote to each other. She then became a journalist and was very successful in her own right. So it's sort of individual collections, a couple's collections, and yet, you know, researchers and those with an interest in a range of different fields would find, you know, this particular collection fascinating.
So there's such a range of items in the collection, and they range from, you know, the tiny royal walnut.
Yes, we heard about the royal walnut. That's a curio, isn't it?
That's a curio.
Do we know who put that walnut together?
Oh, it's in one of our pictures collections. It's sort of it's in a collection of different items that
we'll
have come.
We'll provide a link to it on
website. We'll work it up on our website as well.
Through to the murals, the murals and the going into Queen's Hall, which has just been opened up and which have been treated. They were treated.
They're lovely,
and they're beautiful.
They're from the 1930s, are they?
23 and 29. So they're our war memorial, really. And it's for the first time in decades the public can see them. And they've been treated recently. On a giant scaffold, which was very scary to stand on.
Imagine. How much direct access does the public have to all of those books, Anna?
Complete access. The collection belongs to us all, of course, as a
What about the really rare
community.
Books and the precious books that I can't just go up to the counter and say, bring me down a... Do we have a Gutenberg Bible?
You can. We've got a leaf of a Gutenberg Bible. But if anyone out there has a Gutenberg Bible,
they would need to donate it to the library,
That's right. The entire collection is accessible. We have a dedicated reading room for the more rare and fragile items that when you request, the material's brought there for you to read and with, you know, with expert staff there to help with the handling. Yep. But absolutely everything is accessible to our public.
And I think, you make a really good point, because at many similar libraries around the world, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. You come in, you have to demonstrate your academic credentials to actually get access. All of our collection is available to everyone. And I think for us, we want to let people know what's in the collection so that more can come and look through it and see it, and we can share more items.
So we work really hard at making it available in different ways. So something might be incredibly fragile, so then we'd have a digitised copy that's readily available for as many people as possible.
And also our exhibitions are a really important sort of mode of access for people to see what's in the collection that might, you know, inspire them to come in and look more closely.
Well, I think a big surprise, I'm sure it would be for many people, it was for me, you know, several years ago when I discovered it, is that the State Library actually has quite a substantial picture collection.
Mm. Absolutely.
You have, you know, the prints and the drawings, but paintings and paintings of real historical and cultural importance, not at the NGV, but actually at the State Library.
And I think the difference between the collection that we might have compared to the NGV is that we're telling the stories of Victoria. So, you know, our focus is on what that particular image tells us about the history of Victoria. So, as you know, the gallery and the museum and the library were all on the one site. So you can imagine as the gallery moved off and then the museum moved to their own sites, there was a distribution of collection.
Yes. that's where to put it. You mean a flat-out fight, an absolute turf war. You'd imagine.
Can't confirm or deny that.
And I mean, you wouldn't let some of that stuff go without a fight.
Well, I wasn't there for those discussions.
Imagining.
It's quite interesting that at the time decisions were made that, you know, some of, you know, our artwork didn't go to the NGV. And I think that in retrospect, Tony would probably like
that. Some of the social history, it just wasn't popular at the time. And so... We got a lot of the social history, which is fantastic, you know.
Do you have enough space in which to show it?
Well, look, you never have enough space, but that's part of the redevelopment is a new gallery called the Victoria Gallery, which was supported by the John and Miriam Wiley Foundation. And that is a beautiful space whereby we are able to really showcase some of our stories. So at the moment we have an exhibition, Velvet Iron Ashes, and we have the ashes there. But actually the ashes are just one item in a gorgeous story of linked stories of individuals, which is just a beautiful way to kind of spark interest, because ultimately so many of our items tell a story within a story, and that's kind of more interesting than the item itself. And Shelley, you might want to talk a little bit about the dress.
Yes, so we've got the Jessie Clark costume on display, which is fantastic. It represented, she was in a pageant, she was the centre of a pageant, and she represents the industry of Victoria. Or
I've seen the dress. You've seen it? It's amazing, and it tells the story of well, manufacturing, electricity, generation.
She's got the Yallourn power station
on her head. No one's ever thought to wear that before, but
or again.
Yeah, great Christmas
to make that displayable, we had to do quite a lot of work on the cloak, and so we said we had a glitter issue, but a lot of the glitter was falling off. So it's sort of a lead, it's actually lead glass glitter.
Oh wow.
So we did some analysis on that,
using body protection, I would like.
Well, it's actually quite safe, but it just wants to fall off, you know, after about 90 years of being stuck on the velvet, it just wanted to fall off. So we had to do a lot of consolidation of that, and a reconstruction of all the underpinning so you get the right shape.
Yeah.
So we've got a specific sort of mannequin, and then we had to build her up so she was, you know, the right shape and form for this fantastic dress. And then we made a reconstruction of the Yallourn Power Station headdress by a hat maker called Philip Rhodes, who works at the Arts Centre in Ballet. He made this fantastic headpiece.
Recreate it. It's worthwhile going to see.
It's mad.
One of the few times an ageing power station will ever be used as costume.
It's beautiful.
Anna, what does your work as a book historian teach you about the way that we've printed and published books over the centuries, and the more successful ways in which we've done that versus other ways?
Well, I think the main thing that it tells me is that this is still an ongoing story. We have an ongoing love affair with the form of the book, and although we do live in an age of digital information production and sharing, we haven't yet moved past the joy of the printed work. But also there's aesthetic pleasure in the form of the book and in typography and all the arts that go into making a book. But there is also a serious kind of element which goes back to what you were talking about earlier, to do with accuracy of information, that the printed written record is our historical record of fact or of, authoritative information.
Yeah, it is. Shelley Jamieson, Anna Welch and Kate Tawney are with you on The Conversation Hour. On The Conversation Hour. And we are now all joined by Jay Debgar, tabla player and teacher, to talk about the South Bank Dawn Raga series, the summer edition. And you've got a beautiful instrument, Jay, good morning, there to play for us.
Yeah, good morning, all of you. First of all, thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure.
Over here. So,
can you play something for us?
Oh, yeah.
What are you thinking of playing? What's the name of this piece?
Okay, so the instrument what I'm going to play is called the tabla. It comes from the northern India, and it's about 400 to 500 years old instrument. And this is one of the main percussion instrument being used in Indian classical and non-classical music. So I'm just going to give you a very short demonstration about how it sounds.
Okay. Fantastic. Oh,
thank you for that.
And why don't you describe the drums for us? I'll do a bad job, but you physically describe.
Okay, so it's a set of two drums. Basically, one, the big drum provides the bass, and the small drum provides the treble, like most of the other common percussion instruments. And the skin is also made out of goat skin, and it's completely a handmade instrument. It's like an acoustic instrument. not really any kind of machineries or any specific tools being used. And it's like it's an art of even making this instrument and getting the particular sound out of it.
Well, I'm sure. And it's one of the most amazing things about drums, wherever you go around the world, that in essence, they're all the same thing. It's the skin of something stretched over a large bowl shape in order to make a sound. And yet every single drum culturally is completely different and makes completely different sounds.
Yeah, the most amazing part of this instrument, though, is that whatever we play on this drum, we can actually recite the same thing. So it's like, you know, learning altogether a new language of drumming. So each and every little stroke has got its own syllable or the name. Mm. So when we learn, we actually learn the whole composition. We learn how to sing it and then we play it on the tabla. And tabla is considered to be one of the most fastest percussion instrument in the world.
So you learn to sing it first. And
yeah, so I mean, if I were to play, like, say, ta. Mm.
So could the piece that you played, could you play a little bit of it again and sing it at the same time?
Yeah,
then?
So like, say, da, din, din, da, da, din, din, da, da, din, din, da, perikita, din, din, da, 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 da,
Make play that sound for us, that really sort of deep bonging sound.
So
it sounds like a water drop.
Yeah, so that sound is coming out of the bass drum. So when we play this stroke, basically we
use the
play
heel
the
of your
stroke
hand.
And then slide our wrist over the skin and we put a little bit more pressure as we go forward. And
it's the base of your hand that is actually controlling sound.
Yeah, and the small drum, which is called the tabla as well, is being tuned in a particular note of the music. So we can have different notes of a tabla tuned in a particular note, and then we basically play along with the main tonic note of the instrumentalist or the vocalist accordingly. Mm.
How long have you been playing for?
Well, it's been a long time. I started when I was about 5 or 6 years of in age. So it's been about 28, 30 years easily, I would say, yeah. It's a long process, but it's an amazing, amazing, amazing instrument.
Yes.
I mean, once you start getting the response back from the instrument, you sort of just enjoy playing this drum. Yeah.
Jay, was it this kind of music and playing and performing music, has it always been in your family?
Yeah, well, I come from the family of tabla makers. Making these drums is our family business. So my late grandfather also used to be from the same business. But
Whereabouts?
I come from the northern part of India, from the state called Gujarat.
Yes.
And the name of the town is called Ahmedabad. So we still run our family business over there, and I also import these drums and repair them and sell them, apart from teaching and performing. Mm.
So you can you could make a tabla if you needed to?
Yeah, I do.
And could you use Australian elements to make it, or would it not sound
the
same?
Well, we don't need to really, because most of the things, you know, comes already from India. Because
but would the sound be different if you used an Australian?
Well, definitely,
skin?
It won't be a different thing. I mean, it might even sound better also from the sound what we are getting right now. So, but I mean, we still haven't tried the Australian goat skin, especially for making the tablas. But I'm pretty sure. I mean, it wouldn't be a bad idea if we look at it.
Yeah. Give me a business idea.
That's right. A bit of cross-cultural fertilization. Yeah. So to whom do you teach the tabla?
Well, I basically teach the tabla to whomsoever is interested, but I do have got quite a few, you know, students coming from the different backgrounds, Indian, Sri Lankan, Afghani, and because since it's such an advanced instrument, and tabla has been used in not only in Indian classical or non-classical, but also in world music, jazz music, fusion music, because of the so much of a variety and the scope you can do with this drum. So these days, tabla has actually started getting so much of, importance that quite a few, even Western people, are also interested in learning. And I do have quite a few students who are not from the Indian background. Mm.
Yeah. It's interesting to track the taste, if you like, the changing taste that Westerners have in music from time to time. And if you think back to the 60s and 70s, when tabla started to turn up a lot more, it was prevalent in popular music as musicians were traveling the world, going to India and bringing that music back with them. Yeah. And you hear it. And then it wanes again and you don't hear it so much. How do you account from your experience for what's why it becomes popular, why it disappears again, why it returns?
Well, I haven't really experienced that it sometimes disappears. Like what I can see as far as myself is concerned, that day by day it is just the popularity and the importance of tabla is just increasing. That is how I would say. Otherwise, like say, if I talk about myself as a full-time professional tabla player, I would not be able to survive in Melbourne, because this is not a local instrument. I'm not playing the local music at the same time. Yeah. Okay. So you can see that there would be a lot of demand, and the scope for, you know, using these drums in different kinds of music, not other than the Indian classical music. Mm. So according to me, actually, I would say it's getting more popular day by day. Yeah. I haven't really seen that. Sometimes it goes down. No, I don't think so.
And you're available to collaborate with other musicians.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. Yes.
I think it's a fair point to make. Yeah. Are there musical instruments in the State Library collection?
That's a good question. A question on notice, I think.
We'll have to investigate. Yeah.
But
I would be surprised.
Mm. Are there musical?
Bound,
there's got to be
musical manuscripts.
Yes,
certainly there are.
Tell us about those. What do you know about it?
Well, we actually have some on display at the moment in the World of the Book exhibition, which is in the Dome Gallery. It's a very beautiful part of the library. We have medieval musical manuscripts, so going back to the 13th century, but also musical material through Australian collections in the manuscript collections and through the arts collection predominantly. Yes, yeah.
Shelley, anything you wanted to add there?
We've got recordings.
Come a little closer to the microphone.
We've got recordings. We've actually got the ABC Singles Collection.
ABC what?
Singles Collection.
What are the ABC Singles?
They're the EPs, 45s. Yeah.
Did we produce pop songs at a certain
point?
No, yeah. But as you were culling your collection, you came to speak to the State Library about what that tells us about a period of time in.
I see what you mean. Yeah. When we got rid of our library, is what you're saying.
Well, we did,
and I think it was a dreadful shame. It was just such a joy having that library just there in the building, and to be able to go and grab music and it was really, as a broadcaster, and as a broadcaster who's been going for so long, it was a really important collection, I think.
Well, this collection, I think, came into the library a few decades ago, and it was when they were culling sort of albums and EPs, et cetera. So I do think that's a snapshot that tells you what was happening culturally at that point in time.
It is a social history. The order that it's in is really interesting. Yes. So you have things like Engelbert Humperdinck next to the Hoodoo Gurus.
Yeah.
You know, and it's still kept within that order of how it arrived.
Another collection is the Emerson collection, which is a similar thing, kept in the order. So it's...
Absolutely. So that's a rare book collection that came to the library as a bequest in 2015. And it was the collection of a man called John Emerson, who was a Melburnian, a lawyer, QC. And he was really interested in the English Civil War, so the 16th and 17th century English history, and particularly the print culture of that era. So he amassed a collection that is of equal significance, or, you know, the next greatest collection of that material outside the British Library and the Bodleian Library in the UK.
Here in Melbourne.
And he left it as a gift to the people of Victoria. And one of the conditions of the gift was that we keep it in his shelf order. So that's something that throws fear into the heart of Dewey.
Decimal lovers, exactly.
But we managed to do that.
And is the shelf order eccentric?
No, it's not eccentric, but it is representative of his use of the collection, his reading habits, and his understanding of the material that he had gathered together.
Oh, amazing. Mm. Are there some very precious and important and older tabla drums out there collected or exhibited or owned, Jay?
Yes. So as far as I know, at Monash University, they have got a huge collection of these Indian musical instruments.
What, do you know why? Only-
Sorry?
Do you know why Monash in particular has that?
Well, there have been, I mean, they are offering this music course also in study, which also covers a bit of Indian classical music, and also you can do some PhD and some research also on Indian classical music. But, I mean, I don't know the specific reason behind why have they got it, but like as far as I know, they have got a huge collection of not only just the tabla, but all the other Indian percussion and the string instruments as well, like say sitar and veena, and there are so many string instruments as well, yeah.
What's the role of the teacher in the playing of the tabla? How important is it, and is it distinctive for the kind of music you will go on to play, the kind of teacher who taught you? Is there a school, if you like, of or a styles of tabla playing?
Yeah, so, I mean, say, it's such an advanced and technical instrument. If we talk about tabla, you definitely need to have a guru. I would not name a teacher, but the guru who would actually, you know, like, you know, give you the knowledge of and the skills of how to play
the
tabla.
In this context, what's the difference between a guru and a teacher?
Well, teacher, I mean, like the way the Indian culture works, you know, when we go to the guru, we basically are surrendering our whole self and we are just, you know, trying to just learn the art and acquire the knowledge and the skill of not just learning the instrument, but by also learning this instrument, we are also learning, trying to, you know, learn how the way the life works and how to become an artist and the philosophy behind it and all. Yeah. So whereas in the teacher, teacher is like a little, the way the Indian culture we think that it becomes a bit mechanical, that we go to the school or the university and we just learn a subject from a teacher. But whereas the, and if you see, like in Indian culture, we give a lot of importance to the arts, and it's like even our gods and goddesses also have got the musical instruments in their hands. So we give a lot of respect. We don't even sit with the shoes on when we are playing this music, or we bow down to the instrument and remember the god and remember the name of the guru, and then we actually play it. So it's like a very spiritual and holy art for us, and
I think you should know that in talking to us today in the conversation hour, Jay is seated on the floor with his drums. We're all, you know, up here on chairs, but Jay is down there where the musical instruments are, which makes the conversations actually
and I'm not
even
wearing
more powerful.
My shoes as well, as you can see,
and no shoes are, that's how the shoes are off, so forgive us having our shoes on.
Discipline. It's beautiful.
Yeah,
yeah, it is. Well, we better rip around then. Summer Reid, Kate?
Look, too much lip. That's my book
Melissa
of the year. Yes.
Yeah.
And also Bruni by Heather Rose. Loving that at the moment too.
Oh, great. Anna? Please say something from the 16th century.
Yeah, I can do. At the moment, actually, I'm reading a lot of the poetry of Rainer Maria Rilke. I would highly recommend him to anyone who needs a little bit of time out from the world.
Shelley?
Mm. I'm probably a year or so behind, but I just read Lincoln and the Bardo. Mm. Fave.
Jay, would you have a reading suggestion for summer?
Well, I have been reading the book on Pandit Ravi Shankar Ji and his biography. So that is also one of the book I would recommend everyone if you are interested in knowing about the music and the artist and all.
Very smart idea. And I will just say, yes, for you, the Arts Centre tomorrow on the main lawn tomorrow, you'll see Vinod Prasanna on flute and Jay on tabla. And that's on the main lawn tomorrow, Tuesday the 10th of December at 7:30. It's free, but bookings are essential.
Yeah, so basically Arts Centre is presenting the whole series, which is going to go up till March, and we have got a really great lineup of musicians.
And that will be February and March. And it's thank you to Kate Tawney, who's been here from the State Library, Anna Welch and Shelley Jamieson as well. Don't forget to tune in to Stephanie this afternoon for the afternoon program. Great to have your company today. I'm back tomorrow from 8:30. Go well.